Will our marshal please call us to order?
All right. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eid, Judge Werke, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Keala Eid presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our Zoom oral argument calendar today. I will just go over some housekeeping matters with counsel. This is obviously being broadcast on Zoom. There will be a recording of the argument that will be available on our website later today or tomorrow. That is the only recording that should be made of these proceedings. There are no other recordings. Counsel for the appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. You should be able to see the timer if you're in gallery mode. That should be up on your screen. And counsel for the respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin, if you could please just identify who you are and the party you represent and how you'd like us to refer to you. The first case on our calendar this morning is A230416, State of Minnesota versus Omar Abubakar Mani. And counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravili. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Omar Mani. This appeal challenges the sufficiency as well as the merit of the evidence in this case. The primary argument relates to counts 3 and 4, as those relate specifically to one of the accusers, Ms. Malith. And the rest of the argument deals overall with all of the counts. Due to the unusually conflicting nature of the evidence, the disappearing alleged weapon, and questions about the injuries that the evidence just did not clearly establish. But for the arguments dealing, as I said, primarily on counts 3 and 4, it is worth noting those counts were really changed, not added, just before closing arguments, changing from an assault to an attempt, and then just assault fear. It was based on the testimony that was elicited at the trial where Ms. Malith quite clearly submitted false testimony during her direct examination about being cut in the hallway of this apartment building because one of her fellow accusers then established in her own testimony that the cut to her happened inside the apartment from a chair. It was also elicited at trial that before the trial, Ms. Malith had told the police that, yes, she was injured in the apartment. I found this to be very striking and unusual, and it is on that basis that in this argument I'm relying on essentially the analysis from this court's Foreman decision in 2004, which examined claims of insufficient evidence based on accuser credibility problems. In Foreman, they reviewed prior cases like Huss, in which the accuser's credibility was seriously lacking and there was contradictory evidence. Foreman itself found that the accuser in that case was not contradicted, and therefore it was a matter of, as usual, deference to the jury.
Mr. Maravili, I'd like to just talk a little bit about, you know, where's the line between testimony that's inconsistent and testimony that you assert here was just demonstrably false? And why should we consider on these unique circumstances that involve such a chaotic situation and multiple victims, why should we conclude here that line between inconsistency and demonstrably false testimony was crossed?
The line, Your Honor, that I'm drawing here goes beyond inconsistency. It is about the clear contradiction that is present. And now I'm again specifically addressing my primary argument on counts 3 and 4 relating to Ms. Malith. She was contradicted not just by her own pretrial statement, but by the other accuser, Ms. Manuan. And that's where I find the difference, and that's why I find Foreman at least persuasive on this point. I mean, I suppose Foreman is distinguishable because, again, they affirm the conviction in Foreman. But I do think this court drew a line, as you phrased it, Your Honor, between simply inconsistent testimony, which I understand on the standard of review, you know, that's up to the jury. But throughout my brief, the case law that I've submitted, whether Foreman or the Ibrahim case or the Kemp Supreme Court case from 65, do note the power of appellate courts on review to re-examine testimony that is not merely inconsistent, but either contradicted by other evidence or utterly lacking in plausibility. I do submit that that is what is left upon a thorough review, not just of Ms. Mollith's testimony, but the evidence as a whole.
Mr. Marvili, wouldn't your argument have more force if count three hadn't been amended to an attempt and it, you know, the state would have had to rely on there actually being contact between your client and the victim in counts three and four?
Your Honor, I anticipated that question. I was just thinking about the fact that what I believe the prosecutor argued in his closing was that the attempt occurred in the hallway. But what I have pointed out in my brief is that there was actually no evidence from anybody else that Mr. Mani ever swung anything at Ms. Mollith in the hallway.
I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, we had not only all three victims, but eyewitnesses and photographic evidence of a lot of blood in the hallway. And all three consistently did say he was swinging a knife or something of that nature at them. So isn't that enough that the jury heard that and they could decide what was true and what wasn't?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think those points go more to the second part of my argument, the counts as a whole. The point that I made prior to your question was that I carefully examined the testimony of all three of the other alleged victims and the neighbor, Ms. Byers. And at no point in their testimony did any of them say they saw Mr. Mani swing something specifically at Ms. Mollith in the hallway. This has to be coupled with the fact that she sat on that witness stand and claimed that he not only swung at her, but cut her. She was contradicted by her own friend who said the injury occurred in the hallway or in the apartment.
But didn't the victim number three, I think the other, one of the two AMs, as I recall that testimony, that victim talked about everything happening in the hall and she testified that your client slashed us. Isn't that evidence that if victim number one wasn't actually injured in the hallway, there was a threat and a basis for her to be fearful?
I would submit respectfully, Your Honor, that that reference to us refers to herself having been injured and the other woman who was also injured. Two of the four women were actually injured. And well, that spills into the second part of my argument as to where and how those injuries occurred. But I, to answer your question as directly as I can, I don't think that AM's testimony about us being swung at can be reasonably applied to Ms. Mollith, given her contradicted testimony, the lack of specificity, and the lack of support that came from Ms. Byers, who had a front row view of what was going on in the hallway and didn't. She said she couldn't see him swinging at anybody specifically. I'm simply arguing the lack of specificity, which I think has to be supplied here. This is not so much a matter of inconsistency. It's a lack of evidence. And again, counts three and four are founded on claims by a contradicted accuser.
Is your argument that if your client was generally swinging a knife at all three women, but not specifically directing it at one of them, that he wouldn't have the required intent for counts three and four because he never made contact with, in your view, the victim in counts three and four?
For the tail end of that question, Your Honor, I now believe that my answer to your question is yes. that is why I put a section in my brief about with an attempt, the intent has to be specific, and therefore the state must provide evidence of that specific intent, not general. See, that's the problem here for the state on count three. If you're going to go ahead and say, well, he attempted to do it, where's the evidence of specific intent? It's not there. Now, if I may, perhaps use this as a segue to the rest of my argument, because really what's driving the second part of my argument is, where is this so-called machete? It simply raises too many questions of plausibility, because the knife, and by the way, I should go back to your question briefly, Judge Eady, and say, I'm not conceding for this appeal that there was a knife in that hallway at any point. Mr. Mani testified that he had a cosplay sword, which looked very much like a machete or ninja blade, but is not a weapon. And
you agree that at the very least, the circumstantial evidence standard would apply to this issue of whether or not there was a dangerous weapon proved. Is that your position?
Certainly, at the very least, yes.
So my question is, let's just talk about one of the circumstances proved, which is the amount of blood that was described in the hallway and the injuries to the two victims who had slashes. What is a reasonable inference other than guilt regarding the dangerous weapon issue that we can infer from the circumstances proved?
Well, Your Honor, you're making me realize I might have been able to express more clearly in my brief the fact that, you know, I would concede that these injuries could very well have happened in the apartment. In the apartment. Okay, the blood in the hallway could certainly be explained that way. But I also, having looked carefully at the photos, found, based on the injuries described, the amount of blood to be remarkably lacking in the hallway. I couldn't understand why there were just little dots and tiny trails of it, given the horrific nature of the injuries described. I mean, it occurred to me that the injuries could have been minor at first, but because of the fracas that ensued, not only in the apartment, but after Mr. Mani ran down the hallway after them, and they, according to Ms. Byers, went after him and were wildly swinging their phone cords, that those injuries could have been worsened in that regard. I don't.
Can I stop you for a second? Because on the first step of the circumstantial evidence analysis, right, if there's a conflict as to what the circumstances proved are, we reconcile those in favor of the verdict, right? And so then it's whether or not the inferences drawn from those can point to anything other than guilt.
Yes,
Your Honor. So, you know, I understand your client testified he never had a knife in the hallway. He didn't swing a knife. There was talking about a phone cord, where it occurred. But we take care of that at the first step. At the second step, my question is, what is the reasonable inference other than guilt that we can infer from the circumstances proved?
The reasonable inference that can be allowed here for something other than guilt, specifically by slashing with a knife, I think arises from the fact that the only knife that was ever actually described in evidence was the butcher knife that was on the apartment floor.
What do you mean by described in evidence? Because many people spoke of a machete. You mean admitted to evidence, a photograph of the butcher
physical
knife?
I shouldn't have said described. I meant physical evidence, because the police turned that apartment upside down. They searched it for over an hour. They actually found a fake katana sword that one searching officer said that he saw a handle. It wasn't seized, so it wasn't a weapon. The only knife that was actually found was the one laying on the floor.
Are you advancing the position that in any case where a weapon isn't found and it's an assault of this type, that the dangerous weapon requirement can never be proven?
I am advancing that theory in this case, Your Honor. I'm not attempting to apply it to cases in general. I'm just saying that you have to couple that also with the markedly differing descriptions of this so-called weapon. I mean, Ms. Manuin said she thought she saw two knives in the hallway. Ms. Byers said that whatever Mr. Mani was waving around was flopping. She said it looked like a belt. Then she said she saw something that looked like a machete. But this has to be compared to Mr. Mani's own testimony about how he had a cosplay sword, which is not a weapon.
And again, how is that consistent with how we view circumstantial evidence? We don't. The jury rejected that aspect of your client's testimony. So why does that come into our evaluation at all?
Well, as I understand the standard, this court does not defer to the jury's judgment when considering reasonable alternatives. And in this case, the X factor is that everybody agreed there was a wild fracas in the apartment before they all went out. And things were being thrown. Mr. Mani described Ms. Moloth being the one who grabbed the kitchen knife from the kitchen. I realize that's a separate credibility determination, but there is no deference to the jury's judgment when it comes to considering reasonable alternatives. The lack of blood in the hallway, the incredibly varying descriptions of this so-called knife, its utter disappearance, including the fact that Mr. Mani went out of his apartment to leave the building and went right by Ms. Byers, and she didn't see anything on him. It would be difficult to hide this supposed long machete blade. It simply disappeared. Those are the facts. The reasonable alternative is that he did not commit this offense as described. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, counsel. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas, and I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I guess instead of telling you things about the case that you've already read and know, perhaps I might do my best to answer any questions that the court might have right off the bat. Is there anything the court would like to ask of me right at this point?
Well, what's your response to counsel's argument that the conflicting, inconsistent testimony by Ms. Maloth should necessarily mean that there isn't sufficient evidence for counts 3 and 4?
So Sergeant Ryan Lodenmeyer observed what he described as a large surface laceration on Ebel Maloth's lower back. She's the victim for count 3. And I think she told him words to the effect that it was a little unclear as to how she got the laceration. There had been a physical altercation in the apartment preceding the events in the hallway. And remember, the events in the apartment are not part of the charged behavior here. She testified that she felt something strike her back as she was running in the hallway. So I think even Ms. Maloth is not entirely clear how she may have obtained that laceration. And it may have come from more than one source. And I think that's why the prosecutor instructed on count 3 in alternative ways, being attempt or the intentional infliction of, or the intent to cause an imminent fear of bodily harm.
Well, what do you make of the argument that even if the testimony were credited that Mr. Mani was wildly swinging the object, knife at all three women in the hallway, he didn't have the specific intent as to Ms. Maloth that would be required for counts 3 and 4. What's your response to that?
Well, as the court knows, we prove intent by circumstances surrounding it. The testimony from the defendant, and I don't know that it was disputed, was that Ebel Maloth aim at him in the apartment with a butcher knife. And in fact, there was a knife matching that description found on the floor of the apartment. And the kinetic fight in the apartment seemed to be centralized on Ms. Maloth. So he had certainly had a motive of all the women to attack Ebel Maloth. His behavior, at least as it relates to Ajak Manion and Agu Mabor, he inflicted substantial injuries onto those with his machete. Ms. Malath describes
him. You talk about a machete, but you know, appellant counsel is arguing that there wasn't that much blood evidence. At least he says not that much blood evidence in the hallway, and that that's akin to not necessarily being a dangerous weapon that would have inflicted any injuries. Do you have any response or comment to that?
Well, boy, the trial prosecutor put in, I mean, I'm looking here, this must have been 20 exhibits of blood. There was blood all over the hallway. I guess I just fundamentally disagree with this statement that there wasn't much blood. There was blood everywhere. There was blood on the floor, blood on the walls, and this is in the hallway. There was a lot of blood everywhere, which would indicate not just a cutting, but a swinging of a blade that had fresh blood on it. I mean, unless maybe the victims brushed against the wall, but the spatter evidence indicates a distribution from a swinging. And unless the victims were vigorously swinging their legs and arms around such that it would create spatter wounds, that the, if you go through all the different photos of all the different blood, it was a lot of blood. So again, there's five eyewitnesses testified that Mr. Mani had some type of machete or knife, that he was swinging it at these women. At the very least, it supports the attempt. I mean, had he not made contact with anybody, that would give more force to the appellant's argument. But he clearly injured at least two of them. And Ms. Malath herself felt that she got hit in behind by something. I think that more than supports the jury's finding of fact that he attempted to inflict harm on Ms. Malath.
Do you agree that the butcher knife that was found that in the apartment, that was not by anyone's theory the weapon that was allegedly used or the jury found was used in the assaults?
I wouldn't say that necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, again, we go back to the eyewitness testimony. There was some eyewitness testimony that there may have been more than one blade. The sheath itself that was found in the apartment had space for more than one blade. It's not inconceivable that the butcher knife on the floor was the weapon. There was no blood found on it.
Wasn't there also a handle of a knife coming out when the officer first entered the apartment from a closet?
I'm not clear about that. And that there may be, that was the perception, but I think when they went in and looked at the sheath, there's no evidence of that. And, you know, in other words, there's no exhibit found. So I'm not clear about that. There may have been something they looked in the closet, thought they saw something, but maybe it didn't turn out that way. It wasn't clear to me about that. But the testimony, you know, at the trial was that they did recover this sheath, which I think also supports Ms. Byers' testimony about him, you know, hitting them with a belt. I mean, it's very conceivable. There was testimony about him having a sheath and the sword, and he may have been, you know, flailing about with this sheath, which would have looked like a belt. You know, I guess I disagree with the general assertion that these eyewitnesses' testimony is inconsistent. I mean, all five of them describe a knife or machete of some sort. All five eyewitnesses, including Ms. Byer, who has no dog in the fight here, describe him with a machete or a knife. I mean, if all five witnesses' testimony was precisely the same, I might be more suspect. It may smack of you know, manufactured testimony, but they differed in the small ways that we would expect eyewitness testimony under such a kinetic and confusing scene. I think the testimony in its material parts is very consistent with the verdict. Judge Eade had asked about, you know, whether they were advancing a theory as to not finding the knife. I think there's, and I suggested in my brief, but in one's clothing, one could certainly secrete and hide a blade. Certainly, if you just hold the knife on the opposite side of your body from the people that might see it, you could explain how he could have taken the knife.
Does it really matter if the whatever was used was not found? I mean, does that make any difference?
No, I cited the Washington v. State case in my brief in a situation where I think the facts were that even the victim himself wasn't sure if it was a knife that caused it. No, there wasn't the direct testimony we have here. I mean, this is more than a circumstantial evidence standard. We have direct evidence five eyewitnesses that describe what they believe to be a knife. So that's direct evidence, not circumstantial evidence. But and that direct evidence is amply supported by the nature of the slash wounds that we see in Exhibits 72 and 73 on Ajack Mannion's leg. So, no, I think the case law would say that the jury is they can certainly infer that, one, we have direct evidence, and two, we have circumstantial evidence that the wounds were caused by an edged weapon. And if you want to call it a cosplay sword, maybe these are labels, but a long straight edge weapon capable of causing those deep slash wounds. Ms. Agumabor had to have surgery on her arm and testified how it's still not quite the same. We're not talking about a rubber blade here, something that caused serious injury.
With respect to victim number one, I mean, the evidence doesn't support an injury caused by a knife of the type that everyone is describing. You agree with that?
You're talking about Ebel Maleth in count three?
Yeah.
No, yes, and that's not right. That's not what the state alleged. They instructed the jury on attempt and intent to cause immediate fear of bodily harm. So no injury was required in count three. It's just that he had tried to assault her or attempted to assault her, or alternatively, in the what we'll call count four, is that he acted with the intent to cause her imminent fear of bodily harm. And as I point out in my brief, I think her testimony and all the other surrounding testimony, that's quite a reasonable inference. When someone's chasing down the hallway with a machete, hacking your friends, and there's blood being spattered on the walls, I think anybody would be in imminent fear of imminent bodily harm under those circumstances. So either counts three or four were amply supported. So regardless of how Ms. Maleth may have gotten that large laceration on her lower back, it doesn't matter with respect to this verdict.
Mr. Haas, Helen's lawyer indicated that on our standard review, we owe no deference to the jury's judgment as to inferences that can be drawn from the circumstances proved. Do you agree with that? And how does that affect our analysis here?
Well, we certainly defer to the circumstances proved here. But again, we have direct, it's a mixture here, but we have direct evidence that Agumabor, for example, said, he cut me with that blade. I saw him do it, and here's my wound. Again, we're inferring intent from behavior, and the behaviors that prove his intent are from direct evidence. And the wound itself, again, it's there's direct evidence of a wound, direct evidence of how it's caused on Ms. Mannion and Ms. Mabor. That's the proved behavior from direct evidence that proves the intent or the attempt. So,
well, let's just say to Judge Bjorkman's point, let's just say we disagree and that it's a circumstantial evidence because perhaps the direct evidence isn't enough. And so given that it's both circumstantial and direct, we have to apply the heightened standard. You agree that at the second step, we don't defer to any inferences that the jury drew, correct? I mean, that's the standard, right?
I believe so.
And so then I guess what's your response to the last argument that your counterpart made, which was that there's a rational hypothesis that points to something other than guilt here with regard to the weapon, and that's that his client didn't use a weapon to cause any injuries. What would your response be to that? And is it the state's position that all rational inferences point to guilt here?
The problem with that theory is that we have direct evidence to that very point. It is the defendant's own testimony. When he testified, now we're talking about direct evidence here, he said, I didn't cut anybody with anything. I didn't hit them with a cosplay sword. I didn't hit them with a rubber knife. I just didn't assault them at all in the hallway. That's direct evidence, and the jury disbelieved it. So, I think that inference we don't give, that deference we do give to the jury. As to that, their interpretation of that direct evidence. Had the defendant not testified, then I think that question would be more appropriate. But the jury simply disbelieved that sworn testimony of the defendant that I never struck them with anything in the hallway, whether it was a cosplay sword or not.
So you're saying that's not part of the circumstances proved?
Well, I would call it part of the circumstances that were not proved. I mean, he testified, didn't have to, but he chose to. And he said, I didn't hit anybody with anything in the hallway. And the jury was free to believe or disbelieve that. And I think we know what their verdict was. Had they believed that, he would have been acquitted. Or even if it caused any reasonable doubt, he would have been acquitted. Well, I guess in summary, unless the court has any questions for me, I submit again that when looking at it as a whole, as we do, the collective testimony of these five eyewitnesses was materially consistent, that the defendant had a machete or knife that he used to cause, you know, significant physical injuries to Ajak Manyun and Agu Mabor. And in the context of the preceding physical brawl, if you want to call it, in the apartment, you take it into the totality of the circumstances, it supports the jury's verdict that the defendant attempted to cause harm to Ibu Malith, or that he acted with the intent to cause her imminent fear of bodily harm. So again, taken as a whole, I respectfully submit that the evidence submitted supports the jury's verdict, and I'd ask the court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Whenever you're ready. Oh, you're muted, sir.
Sorry, thank you. I would begin by addressing that circumstantial evidence review question raised by Judge Dover Bjorkman. I would just cite to State v. Harris by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2017, where it specifically says, we give no deference to the jury's choice between reasonable inferences at the second step of the analysis. So that's what I'm relying on there.
But let me just ask you, because when we first talked about this in your initial argument, I just presumed that circumstantial evidence would be the standard that applies. Can you address why direct evidence wasn't enough to prove that it was a dangerous weapon used in this situation with regard to Mr. Haas's argument that five witnesses said there was a knife, five witnesses said he swung a knife of some sort? Why isn't that enough?
Well, I guess what you just said, Your Honor, a knife of some sort, that's the problem here. And I disagree respectfully with respondent counsel that the testimony from all five women was consistent. Not a single one of them described the supposed knife the same way. And they were even differences on how they said they left the apartment. Some said they walked out, some said they ran out, some said they pushed by him, others said he let him go. I mean, there wasn't a consistent thing about their account of this.
But with regard to the knife, does it really matter even if it was a knife? I mean, the law just requires that it be a device or instrumentality, because this doesn't seem to me like it was a design case, right? This is more was a device or instrumentality in the manner it was used or intended to be used. So why wasn't their testimony that he was swinging something in the manner in which he used it or intended to use it indicated that it was a weapon?
But it has to be a dangerous weapon. I made a specific point of addressing this in my brief. The state chose to charge this as assault with a dangerous weapon. They did not ask for a lesser, just regular assault charge, which is what it would be in the absence of a dangerous weapon. Now, these cosplay swords look very real, but they are not weapons. They are not sharp. And just that cloth scabbard that was found in the apartment, that's not what you use for a real machete or ninja sword. You use that for a fake sword. If you've got a real knife, that has a scabbard.
It has. But anything can be used as a weapon under the second definition of dangerous weapon. It can be any device or instrumentality. It doesn't need to be a real sword. It can be a piece of wood. It could be anything, right? I mean, that's what our cases say.
Well, let me stress again, I am acknowledging that the injuries could have occurred in the apartment. It's just that no evidence was presented for that scenario. It's impossible to know how and with what, because no witnesses said that Mr. Monty grabbed a knife inside the apartment, but the women admitting they were throwing things. It was wild. The knife was on the floor instead of in the butcher block. The absence of blood in the apartment.
There was medical. Wasn't there medical testimony that the injuries that were sustained were consistent with a knife?
That was consistent. That's why I'm saying, Your Honor, it may have happened in the apartment. It's hard to say. The injuries could have been slight at first as well, and exacerbated by the fracas in the hallway. Now.
But on the topic of whether the state proved the element of a dangerous weapon, I mean, you would acknowledge that the injuries sustained by the victims 2 and 3, whether in the hall or anywhere else, I mean, are consistent with a dangerous weapon definition as defined by an object being used in such a way that can cause substantial bodily harm.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, only in the general sense. You know, my concern is this case, because the witness testimony, again, is so varied, it is difficult to establish what happened. And I would again point to Ms. Byers, whose first description of what she saw being swung was just a belt. I mean, that's not a dangerous weapon, or at least it wouldn't cause the kind of injuries that were then found at the hospital.
But then she goes on to describe, no, he's holding a machete and he's swinging that.
She simply said, oh, and then I saw a machete. But I'm simply left here by saying that a cosplay sword, such as described by Mr. Monty, would look like that. But it is not a weapon. And I mean, I can't meaningfully dispute the fact that, yes, the absence of that weapon doesn't chuck this case. I know that. But it's just not plausible that it could just go poof like that. And I don't see how you could secret out a long knife like that, just holding it against your body, or worse, trying to stuff it into your clothing. That's utterly implausible. Where did it go? It may have been nothing other than the cosplay knife that one of the searching officers found in the closet. He said it was laying on the floor of Mr. Monty's room. It had a handle. It wasn't seized because it wasn't a weapon. The issue of I'm sorry.
Counselor, just to point out, your time has expired. So if you just want to complete your last thought.
Well, as I reviewed the points I was going to make, I think I've addressed them. So I won't impose on the court anymore. But thank you for your attention very much.
Thank you both, counsel. The matter is taken under advisement. We will issue a decision in the statutory 90-day timeframe.